The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Tusker is my name, and we're stepping into our interview with Dr. Margaret Nackett Chatur, clinical and educational psychologist. She is an educator, assistant professor, Center for Education at the University of Trinidad and Tobago. And the focus revolves around children and youth at risk and their families, inclusion of marginalized groups and suicide in Caribbean populations. So I'd like to welcome you this morning, Doctor, and welcome to Human Impact.
Good morning. Good morning. Good to be here.
So it's sad that we're meeting on these kinds of circumstances to talk about such a ghastly video. I would assume that you've seen it with the blatant disrespect and abuse of a young child by a female relative. And so far, from what I understand in the story, is that the relative has been taken into custody and assessments being made. But going beyond that, what would be the position, or how do we deal with something like that? How do we deal with the trauma of that situation?
All right. Again, thanks for having me, Tusker.
No problem.
There are so many variants to what you have just said. I just want to alert our viewers that April, we're in the month of April, and April is Child Abuse Prevention Month and awareness of the issues. And the color is blue. So if you can wear blue in support of children who are abused everywhere and community sharing prevention strategies. But let's go back to that issue that happened in our country last week. Mm-hmm. And as you know, as Tusker just said, the mother was taken into custody for an assessment. We don't know if the mother has an issue or a history of mental illness or so. But you know, these incidents always come to the fore when a video is happening or somebody is recognized or a child is dead or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I would want to draw attention to the fact that for a very long time, child abuse is happening in this country. Parents who use or who resort to what we know as physical punishment or corporal punishment often do it based on a belief that it will teach their children right from wrong. And you know, many persons would say, you don't know what the child did, but there is no excuse.
There's no
excuse,
yeah,
or no justification for abuse, or that it will correct the behavior, because there is no evidence to show that physical punishment changes the original or the unwanted behavior. So we have to start with that premise. There is no excuse for abuse. But we also have to bring into the conversation this country's and a Caribbean belief that our system of discipline has to be punitive rather than rehabilitative. It has to be used with licks and spanks or beatings or hitting. And many parents are influenced by how they were brought up, by our fathers who would say, well, I come out of it good so I could beat my child. But you know, that belief is influenced by the family traditions, by their own personal experiences. And many adults who have been beaten as children are more in favor of physical punishment rather than those who have not. But again, physical punishment is not supported. It should not be supported. And research says that these children, that little boy in the video, I felt so sorry, you know, they have such long-term effects. And one thing that stands out, is a lot of incarcerated men in our prisons have reported abuse, not by their fathers only, but by mothers who continue to abuse them. And when we hear about the spiraling acts of domestic abuse of men abusing their female partners, we wondered, where did the origin of that come from?
Yeah, because I would think in terms of the situation that it was brought up by that video, we may be speculating, but the instances are so high where it seems to be a transference of anger from the adults onto the child. So it may be that the mother was dealing with and experiencing her own form of abuse and was transferring to the child. How can we analyze and help? Because I'm thinking of the person who filmed that video, you know, being the neighbor. What that neighbor could have done before reaching to that point of having to record it some sort of intervention? What advice or what could have been done to prevent that?
So here we're looking at prevention. We're looking at community reporting. If you see it, say it. Something that I've always advocated for. But many persons now, especially in society, they say, well, that's not my child, that's not my business, I'm not interfering. Mm-hmm. But we are supposed to be a social collective. No matter what is happening, and our children are voiceless. They are the vulnerable ones. So if we see something happening, we should report it, we should say it. And that neighbor, if it was a neighbor who filmed it or so, I'm sure she knew or they knew of the abuse long before it came to what
to
we saw
point.
There.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and imagine filming it when you're seeing a parent actually doing it rather than stepping in to prevent it, because I heard that the mother kicked the child to the ground, the boy was curled up and she pulled him up and she kicked him to the ground again. And for me, that is such a tragic occurrence. And I think that persons who are witness to this abuse, like the neighbor who filmed it, should also be liable, should also be prosecuted. And even though you may say she had the video, but no, they witness it, they condone it in some instances, and they leave it alone. So community reporting is important. Prosecution is important. Witnesses to violence. All of the policies that have been put in place by the domestic violence, and by the family, by the JSC committees who have met many times on this. A witness to this kind of violence has to be prosecuted. And, you know, we always look at this and say, you know, how should we know? How do we know? But there are many signs, and there are common characteristics of parents who beat their children. And usually it is triggered by a lack of impulse control. You know, a parent may be having a bad day or an abusive boss or bullying in the workplace, whatever it is. But physically abusive parents usually assault their children when they have strong negative feelings of their own that they need to let out. Mm-hmm. And who do they let it out? Their child.
So
that first sign is a lack of impulse control and emotion, a feeling of power against someone who is powerless. And we have to recognize that this can happen. And many persons like that usually lack emotional intelligence, you know, that emotional intelligence that would allow them to stop, take a moment to reflect instead of being reactive. And many of them are usually emotionally still children themselves, and they become enraged when the child possibly does not comply, so they lash out,
or they even stand up for themselves, because we have that happening as well, where the child or teenager, depending on the age of the child, you know, you make a stance for yourself because you know to yourself that something is wrong. You know, and I guess from also the encouragement and counseling from outside of the family, if it is that you're going to, you're speaking to a trusted counselor or friend, they give you the tools to say, well, okay, this is what you can do, say this or do that, but end up in more problems. So you can see it's a double-edged sword where this is concerned.
Yes, it is. And many parents do not take advice of well-meaning persons. This is and I spoke of this already. This is a society where we should have a circle of care around our children, where our children feel safe in our schools, in our homes, and our children do not. Many times abuse right now, as we are speaking, abuse is occurring rampantly in our society. I have many adults who come into me, and many of their wounds, their trauma, start in their childhood when they were abused by parents. I have a beautiful, and let me tell you, Tosca, this is not relegated, as many people would think, to poor homes or to lower socioeconomic homes, all right? We have children from upper and middle income households where they are beaten. I started a hotline in 2020 when COVID happened. And because it was a free hotline, we had 18 psychologists. Many persons called them, and you would be amazed at the adults, the 29, 30, 31-year-olds who would call in and tell us that they were beaten by their fathers or their mothers. And these parents were people who were doctors and lawyers and people who should, we assume, know better. So I just want to say this is not related to any lower socioeconomic class. It happens across the board. It happens with parents, as I said, who lack impulse control, who do not have a sense of the emotional intelligences that they have, and possibly influenced by problems with alcohol, with drugs, because as we know, substance abuse is usually a frequent contributor to the breakdown of this impulse control.
I wanted to go back just a little bit to you saying, you know, if it is that you're seeing these examples to report and so on, how, let's go from the perspective of that neighbor who made the recording. Is it that we should put the blame solely on the neighbor for not reporting it earlier? Or do we have information that the person did make a report and was not acknowledged? And how can someone who is making that report protect themselves? Because you did say that they need to be held accountable in some way because they knew. But if it is that they did what was necessary and nothing came out of it, how can the process continue or happen if the choice is not to report anything because, it, you know, I could get into trouble for it, as you said earlier?
So that's a kind of rock and a hard place there.
Yeah.
In the sense of you don't want any fear there, but I think in this society, we are not accountable for our children. I do not think enough is done. Yes, there may be the neighbor who has made the often reports and perhaps they do not carry it further because of a fear of victimization for their own selves and to protect themselves. But too often we have heard of reports, that little boy who the neighbor saw walking down, yes, it's in South in the Pampa, and he walked right into the river and drowned. And yes, she said, you know, I didn't think that was my concern. We need Tosca more and more, I believe, for persons to know that they must. This is something that is not an option anymore.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that, you know, you wonder if it's my child. We need to be involved when we see abuse happening with our children. Too many times persons have been on the sidelines. And as I said, 88% of children who eventually die or are killed are done by parents themselves
or people
and
that they many know.
And many of these cases sometimes go unreported. Why? Because we hear that they were buried in a backyard or thrown somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think we have to stop walking on eggshells. And this is where public awareness is coming. I was very glad to see in The Guardian this morning that the Minister of Gender and Child Affairs has said that she has started a public awareness prevention program of child abuse, heralding the start of the month. And more of this needs to happen. But when I read these things in the papers, I sometimes wonder how many people are reading the papers. How many? Because in the article, it was very well done. You look at all the signs. What do we look out for?
Yes.
What are all of the things? You know, very nice. But who is reading this? And this is where media comes in. Our technology target places where persons can, when they turn on their phones, they can see these things coming. Social target, all of these things. We need more public awareness programs, especially all of the things, as you said, that neighbor, that fear of reporting. We need to know what are the legal ramifications there, what could happen to protect you once you make a report. Mm-hmm. And you know, all of these things.
Well, I just wanted to add here as well that many may not be have access to newspapers, television, phones,
right,
and the type of medium that is highly utilized to spread this message. How can we disseminate the knowledge, though, to make sure that the pockets are not left, that all the pockets are reached? Because some people can't read. Some people, they do hear the radio, but depending on the programming, unless they're listening to a station like Freedom 106.5 FM, they would not get that information. So how do we break that barrier and get that information out?
And what is the medium where most persons have their children other than the home? What is the space? So it has to be either in the schools or in the churches.
Mm-hmm.
We need to speak these things from the podiums. Parents are not going into health clinics. That is not compulsory, but schools are compulsory. You have to have your children attend schools. And within the schools, you have to have, I believe, not only parenting skills programs, because, you know, many persons say, oh, the home. But if parents do not know what to do, if parents do not have the skills, if they do not realize that how they were brought up is not the way, how would we tackle this issue? And many times, you know, people said, go back to the home. I do not believe, because many homes are antisocial. Many homes are the bedrock from where all of this abuse is happening. So it must be in spaces where people are more informed. And the places that I'm thinking of are the schools. I'm an advocate for school, for things happening here where all of the children who are maybe abused, teachers see scars, teachers hear conversations, teachers see what is going on, have training and development programs for all of those who work with children, have parenting skill programs. More and more we need to improve the resilience skills of our children, and this can only happen within spaces, within schools, within churches. But I want to look at schools where, as I said, you must have a space to talk about these issues. Let children know that if they are being abused, it is not okay. Many children, I think, rationalize the abuse, a sort of defense mechanism, because many children want to remain in their homes. They don't want to be taken out of their homes. So they may say things like, you know, mommy's not that bad, or maybe I deserved it, or, you know, that beating made me a better person. All of the defense mechanisms that children use to dissociate themselves from feelings of pain and fear. So they rationalize the act of the parent. Mm. And in schools, this has to be addressed. They have to know that this is not right. So tell someone you trust.
And, well, this the discussion that we're having just triggered this question from someone here. To address the psychological issues of the parent, we still need to focus on the psychological issues of the child. What about the psychological harm to children? Also, it teaches children that violence is acceptable, and then it translates into schools, because within the last year, as school opened up post-COVID, we're seeing so many examples of children who are now, I guess, as you say, given the space to release those kinds of emotions, getting into fights, getting into altercations with their teachers and people in authority. What kind of response should be given to that, understanding that they just came out of a period of isolation, and so that they can become emotionally equipped to deal with these emotions and not act out?
Good comment. They're good questions. School violence is an entire issue by itself. And let me tell you why I say that. Huh? Coming out of COVID and during COVID, child abuse was reported three to six times over the COVID, because you had parents in closed spaces. You had many of them out of jobs. So everybody living in small spaces, and especially parents who have been mentally ill or children, whatever it is, it was a sort of cocktail, a situation waiting to explode. Mm-hmm. So let's look at post-COVID. You have all of these children coming out of those homes, coming out of situations where many times they did not have food to eat, or proper situations, or parents who were unstable, or family neglect. And you go into the schools, and there was this two-year gap where many of these homes did not log on to services. The children were not schooled, and then they go back into, so they skipped out 2 years. Do you expect them now to attend to a curriculum with that gap? Mm-hmm. Many teachers have been to the schools as part of what I do. You visit the schools and you see where teachers are struggling to bridge that gap, or to attend to all of the learning that did not take place. And if you have a class, let's say, of 25 to 30 students, 10 of who would get it? You would want to go with the 10 who get it, and all of the others will be left behind. Mm-hmm. So when we look at schools and the violence, many of these children are trying to catch up. And a lot of them are leaving schools because they do not see the relevance. Mm-hmm. Now, during COVID, many children, I don't know if you're aware, especially boys, did not do their CXE exams because they left schools to get odd jobs, to bring in the money and all of that. And when
to support families,
Yeah, when they get a taste of the money or the fact that it is going away to help it, they're not going to want to go back to school. They don't want to address education. They don't want to address the learning that should happen that is important. So I think that for a very long time, we're not addressing the real issues. We're looking, we want to get everything in place fast. We want to get the job done. We want to get education ahead. And teachers themselves are falling through the cracks. Teachers are struggling, but we're not addressing the social and emotional after effects of COVID. What happened in your home? How did you cope? How can you cope now? How can we address all of those children who would have intellectual disabilities, academic issues, who are ADHD, who lack focus? Who, you know, how are we going to address that? And I think that is as important, if not more important, than addressing a curriculum, because we have these young children, and as you know, children who are in these circumstances will be dysfunctional adults. Would have poor relationships. And as you correctly said, the imitation and modeling that goes on when they see parents who hit, when they see parents who are violent, when they imitate that because they feel that that is the way to react to an issue, to solve a problem in school. Somebody tells you something and you're instead of saying, what is the matter? How can I help? You immediately hit. And we do not ask the question, I think, that is relevant to a lot of our children. Eh? We always say, what's wrong with you? Why again on so? Mm-hmm. Rather than, what has happened to you? Why did you get to this space? Tell me more. Mm-hmm. You know? And we're very quick to label children. Very quick to label children as, I mean, this is a whole conversation.
There, yes, it's so many different aspects that come together. Yeah, because while you're speaking, I'm thinking about, well, our parents, we're talking about schools, are teachers that equipped to deal with a situation? Like, for example, if they do ask the questions, what happened? What brought you to this point? Are they equipped enough to deal with the information that may come to them? Because one of the representatives from the PTA Association did say that there's so many red tape, as she put it, to dealing with issues like these. They may want to jump in and help, but the legal part of it stops them from doing this. And it puts another pressure onto the teacher and the child because no solution really comes forward. And it's almost like a placebo kind of effect until the better can be done. And then time passes and passes and then, you know, nothing is done. So how do we address these things?
And teachers are not supposed to be the counselors or the therapists for the children. As in one of the JSC committees that I was on in 2017, I made a recommendation, however, that teachers need to recognize and refer. So they need to recognize what are the signs and symptoms of abuse. They need to know when a child is not speaking, when a child comes to school sleepy, when a child possibly has scars, that child needs to be referred. And whilst we have social workers and counselors in the system, I do not think we have enough. We have social workers stretched out between 3 and 4 schools. There should be one social worker, one counselor, one guidance counselor, one psychologist in each school, so that when a teacher recognizes in a classroom, they have the space where these children are attended to. The parents are brought in, and it is mandatory. And this is another thing, and many parents do not come into these sessions because they say it's a time away from work. Mm-hmm. HR policies should recognize that parents need to be part of interventions within schools, all of these intervention strategies that are taking place. As I said, it has to be a triangular approach. You can't deal with a child and send them back to a dysfunctional home. It doesn't work because everything is happening there. You must deal with the parent, you must deal with the child, and you have the counselor who would address these issues. So unless we put these measures in place, we do it half-sided, we do a little thing and we said, yeah, quick fix. It cannot be quick fixes in our schools. Trauma happens to children, abuse happens, and interventions, therapy is long-term. There is no quick fix. There is no knee-jerk reactions. There is no counselors in school and say, hurry it up. It can't be like that. Children, let me tell you, before the age of 14, 50% of adults who have issues or psychological issues have had abuse or something happening in their homes before the age of 14. It is as widespread as that. And something you said, I just want to touch on. You said, what are the psychological issues that follow children from all of this abuse? Mm-hmm. And children who have been beaten, I don't want to use the word spunk because that's an American term. They have been beaten or hit or abused or so, they are at a higher risk usually for mental health problems, ranging from anxiety, from depression, to alcohol and substance abuse. Many of them tend to have very poor relationships or go from one relationship to another. Most of these children tend to be aggressive. And I want to alert those persons who work with children, stop the labeling. Stop the labeling in our schools, because children have a self-fulfilling prophecy. You say I'm stupid, you say I'm dumb, you say I'm just like my father. Well, you know what? I will become like that. So, you know, we have, I think, to learn more and more about how children develop. And back to the schools, what is happening during their developmental stages? Why do they become so reactive, etc.?
I have a question coming in here for you, Doctor. The comment goes, good morning, Ms. Martinez. I've listened quite attentively to your most qualified guest. However, I'm a bit confused by her reference to prosecution of a witness for not reporting the matter under reference. Can she inform us as to what measure of protection is afforded to a witness when he or she reports a matter? Is your guest familiar with what happened to the witness who assisted in the investigation of the matter, therefore referenced about the child who drowned in the river in Central? I don't think that the child drowned. However, the question was that he or she was allowed to leave the home and walk the entire area without intervention. I can't remember what was the resolution of that issue, but going back to the video, you know, It's a tough question to answer, but I would like to hear your take on it.
All right, that goes back to what we were speaking earlier on of the, I think it's the Children's Protection Act, where one of the clauses state that if persons are witness to abuse, for example, close family members, etc., they can also be liable. And I don't know what are all of the legal issues there. I don't have it in front of me, but I think if that person making the questions would go back to the Children's Protective Act, and they would see that the clause states that if you have witnessed and if you are you know of abuse that has been happening in homes, you can be prosecuted. And this is to this is to make people more accountable and to let them know. And this is really not to, I think this measure was put in place to let people have more, to be more involved in community reporting. If you see it, say it, don't let it. And this also came to light, I think, when a lot of grannies and aunties were witness to abuse, parents abusing their children, and they sat back and said nothing until it came to a head, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think the policy is aimed at those people who sit idly by, who sit quietly by, and allow abuse to continue.
Or at least to knowingly allow the abuse to continue, because they can do something because they've seen it firsthand. You know, but I think that act as well, I myself, because what you just said there was news to me, in that in someone who is a witness can be held accountable. I never knew that. It's a bit tricky because, like I said, there've been people, because according to the story with the video, the person who recorded the video did say that they made a report. They have been saying, talking about it to other neighbors as well, trying to get some sort of assistance. And that story also applied to the House of Horrors in Valsain, where community members had made reports to the police saying, well, we suspect something is happening in the house. It doesn't seem right. Can you come to the location and ask a question? And nothing was done. So I can understand where people are asking to, if they can be protected up to a certain point, but the onus on reporting it, you know, it's a bit ticklish, because you want to help, but you don't want to get too involved. I think that's where people of Trinidad and Tobago are reaching right now, because they can see, as I said, the ramifications of being too involved. You know, they become fearful and, you know, minding your business, that kind of talk. So it's a rock and a hard place, as you said before. But I'm thinking now from the perspective that the Children's Authority, what can be put in place to let the public know where they stand in situations like these so that they can help and get something started, but not become so involved that they fear for themselves and their own families?
Now, Tosca, I have a different take on that entirely.
Really?
We have to become involved, you know. For mm-hmm. too long, people have sat on the sidelines, people have watched, people have said, this and all of what is happening, this has to be a community, a collective effort. We cannot, you know, a child, we have to think of children in our society who are powerless, who are voiceless,
yeah.
who do not have, who cannot strike back at adults who are hitting them. You know, and most persons who witness this violence are adults themselves or older siblings. Tell someone. There are provisions in the act that says, you know, we make the children feel safe, take them to a place of safety. You know, let the child be placed in the care of a person who is responsible, you know, and all of these things are in the child, the provisions in the act itself. And that is where, as I said, public awareness comes in. We need to know more of this act. We need to know what protects the person who reports and what protects the child. But I do not feel that we should, possibly sit on the sidelines or think of, you know, I got to be protected. No. Mm. When one child, and I always think here, and I go back into the Gospel of Luke, when I always hear this powerful thing, when there were nine, Jesus was taking care of the 99 sheep, and one was lost, and he says, no, not one shall be lost. And he went after, and he looked after, and he went in search of that one sheep. He could have stayed with the 99 and say, I have enough here. No, he went in search of that one sheep that was lost, and he found it. And that, as a psychologist, that spurs me on. Not one child should be left behind, whether it is in the classroom, and whilst we concern for ourselves and, you know, we say we should not be involved, we have to become more involved in the society. For too long, we have been passive about issues. We have not been vocal enough. We have not been resilient enough to say no more. Not one child is going to be left behind. Not one child is going to be abused. It is up to me to make a difference. And I think if we have that ingrained in our minds, then we take a more proactive response to protect our children and to prevent what we see. And you made a point earlier on, which I want to address, in that how many people have phones and how many people read the newspapers and so. And many times, you know, especially during the COVID and all of that, I've always advocated, we have the resources, have mobile vans going into communities that need to hear. Have, you know, for example, International Women's Day, I came out and said, one day is not enough. Mm-hmm. Come on now. Have mm-hmm. all of these advocacies happening throughout there. Go in, talk about, hand out, give out talks to parents, let them come. And I have done this work with some of my own counselors. And you know what makes parents come out? When you give them breakfast and when you give them things to eat, you know, let them come. Let's talk about it over a meal. Let's talk about how we can improve the situation of our children. What if you see something, say something, community reporting, you know, all of these things.
And just to briefly call out some of the rights from the Children's Act for those who are now joining us here on Freedom 106.5 FM and you wanted to find out, the rights are as follows. To be heard, you have the right to express yourself by speaking, writing, or even drawing. A high standard of living, you should be able to go to the doctor, have medicine, clean water to drink, healthy food to eat, and a safe environment to live in. To be protected from harm, to be proud of his or her culture or beliefs. Education, play, and rest. To live with parents unless it is harmful. You should be able to live with your parents once it is safe for you to do so. This means that no one should take you away from them unless it is dangerous for you to stay. And of course, there's a list of responsibilities, and this is according to Childline, which has also given out their numbers as well. In terms of the Children's Authority, do you think that enough is being done to disseminate this knowledge for them to step into situations like these, or should more be done by them?
Children's Authority has a lot on their hands. I know a lot of the persons who work in Children's Authority, and they are good people. They have good intent for the children, but not enough people are personnel on the ground to deal with all of the cases. I heard that per month you have thousands of cases of abuse being reported to Children's Authority. And I think that is a good sign in itself, in that people are coming forward and they are reporting the abuses. But we need a team effort here. We need a collective effort where you have not just the social worker or the counselor, the policeman. You know, you have all of these people going into the homes. And let me tell you something. You see, the attachment styles of children, people neglect to talk about that. Children who are abused, they love their parents. They love their parents. That's mommy, that's daddy. And many of them do not want, whilst we take them out of their safe homes, they don't want to be taken out of their homes. Even domestic violence victims, wives and so, they love their partners. But what do we do? And I have a serious issue this. We take the children away. We take the wives away. We move them from their homes, their places of safety. We need to have interventions in the homes to deal with these fathers who and men who abuse, to deal with these mothers who beat their children, have interventions in the home. Mm-hmm. When we take children, and I have worked with children in homes and so who have been taken out of their homes because of abuse, and they never settle into state homes. They always want to go back home. They want to go back to mommy and to daddy. And so we have to begin
to change
the narrative, you know, to look at it differently, to see how can we keep our families together by providing more services, more counseling, more intervention in families, so that children, their attachment to their families remains safe, remains secure.
And providing safe places is another challenge that I believe the Children's Authority is currently having. For those who do register to foster, for example, to make sure that these places are safe, because you can leave one bad situation and jump into another, and that is a very real issue. We could keep on asking, how can we prevent it, and what are the things needed to be done to create these safe spaces? But I would think that you would say it's more about training and sensitizing individuals as to the right way of doing things.
So if we look at, let's say, a mother who has six children and abuse is happening and they want to take her to a safe space. Mm-hmm. Many of these safe places do not have the accommodation for a mother with six children. And as I said before, a mother knows, even if it's a small two-bedroom apartment or two-room house, a mother has her space. She knows where the food is. She knows how to get together a meal in 10 minutes. She knows that's her little piece of kitchen. That's where the children sleeping and all of that. Mm. Do not move the mother and her children. Move the perpetrator. Get him out. Get him help. I totally advocate for that. You're moving a mother from a safe space to an uncomfortable place. Her children don't know. You're providing more abuse, more trauma for that mother, more trauma for that children. When the perpetrator remains in the house, gets another lady or another woman, and continues to live his life as if nothing has happened. Give me a break. We need to change the narrative in this society. We need to revisit how we look at things. You know, we need to put more focus on keeping families together, remove the abuser, get them help. Many of these people love their children in a very dysfunctional way. Teach them how to cope, how to live. As I said before, and I'll continue to say, we are so focused on breaking up, bashing down, moving rather than building up, rather than putting resources where they should be, Tusker.
Thank you. And it's a conversation that can go on for a little while. I mean, we've got four more minutes within this hour. Any last comments? I know that would have been a closer for you, but let's leave with something positive. How can we look forward in dealing with these examples of abuse, more preventative measures? And if we do see it happening, how can we step in? And what would be your closing remarks to get us to the next point?
All right. So listeners, this April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Let us be advocates for our children in the society who are powerless, who are voiceless. Let us not sit on the sidelines and feel somebody else should do it. We have to do it. There should be more parenting skills program in the society, more training and development of all those who work with children so that they would know the importance of knowing how children develop, and more public awareness, as programs like 106.5 FM have public awareness programs of child abuse on social media, on all of the medias that we know. Our children are important. Our children are the future of the society. Whether we want to recognize it or not, they are the drivers for human progress and human development. But unfortunately, they do not get their voice in all of the discourses that we have. Listen to our children. Listen to them and be advocates for their safety in Trinidad and Tobago.
Dr. Naked Chatu, thank you so much for that riveting information and actually coming on today, taking the time out to give us that information. I appreciate you.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio, Freedom 106.5.